This is Gary Owens. Back in the days when radio was king, there was one daytime radio program standing so far above those around it that it provoked such an intense admiration among its fans that it still dominates some of their lives today, almost 30 years after it left the air. One of those so affected is Jack Foster, who took his tape recorder and drove some 10,000 miles collecting recollections of the stars of Vic and Sade. This program is the result of that expedition. We wish to thank those who participated for giving their time, and Mary Frances Rimer, widow of Paul Rimer, who was the author of Vic and Sade, for her help. Mrs. Rimer is editor of a volume of Vic and Sade's scripts called The Small House Halfway Up in the Next Block. Now here is Bob Arbogast to take us on a little trip to The Small House Halfway Up in the Next Block.
Vic and Sade was a daytime radio program created by Paul Rimer that was on the air from June of 1932 until September 29th, 1944. It was not like any other radio program ever. This is a tribute to Vic and Sade. You remember last time we talked with Bernadine Flynn, who played Sade, with Bill Idelson, who played Rush, with Clarence Hartzell, who played Uncle Fletcher, with Bob Brown, who did the announcing, with Johnny Coons, who played Smelly Clark, among others, and with Franklin McMahon, who, like you and me, loved to listen to Vic and Sade. Now we're going to continue our conversational tour of Paul Reimer's truly unique expression of the everyday humor of middle American life.
Well, sir, the Evening Meal has been over only a little while as our scene opens now. And here in the living room of the small house halfway up in the next block, we find Mr. and Mrs. Victor Gook. Vic lounges in his easy chair with a newspaper, while Sade, occupying a corner of the Davenport, darns gentleman's socks. Sade is speaking at the moment, and rather sharply, too. Listen.
You don't need to titter and get that funny, surprised expression on your face every time I mention going to Carberry next Saturday. We're going to Carberry, and that's all there is about it.
Why, how determined you sound.
Sure, I sound determined.
It's not like you to be so high-handed.
No, there's no reason on earth why we shouldn't go to Carberry either. You've got nothing else planned for on Saturday. You're free as a horse. Well, Vic Gook, you haven't been to Carberry in ages.
You have, though.
Well, of course I have. A dozen times, and Rush, too. But you haven't.
Your sister?
What?
Beth is your sister.
Now, that's a fine, beautiful excuse, that is.
Well, it isn't, is it?
Beth and Walter are your sister-in-law and brother-in-law. And they live right here in Illinois. Not even a whole day's ride on the train. You let year after year go past without visiting them. Why, it's shameful.
I don't notice them coming to visit us.
Well, you appreciate Walter's tied down with the barber shop and all. He can't get loose. But you, you're as free as a breeze. 100 million times I've itched to try to talk you into running up to Carberry, but always knew you'd kick and bellyache and raise objections. Now, an occasion has come along. Something special's on the fire. You can't duck and sneak off and hide your head under your wing.
What's the occasion?
You don't know what the occasion is.
Thunder, just because young Utsy's going to slam off a tune on the half-wit piano is hardly
yes,
sufficient.
Yes, young Utsy's going to slam off a tune on the half-wit piano. For months and months, she's worked and practiced and worked
somebody
and practiced.
Kitchen. Somebody in the kitchen.
Robbers, maybe. You, Willie?
Yeah.
We'll start laying our plans now, this very minute. I'll write Bess a little note, and Rush can mail it tonight so she'll get it tomorrow sometime. I'll tell her to expect the three of us on the IC train that gets in Carver.
I got another picture with me. Evening, lady.
Well, we got company. Hello there.
Hello, Beth.
Come in, Uncle Fletcher. I'm not going to be sidetracked on this now. We're going to Carberry, and that's all there is about it. You can wipe that foolish, perplexed look off your face, too.
I'm getting Uncle Fletcher's society up at the corner of Kelsey Street just now.
How are you, Uncle Fletcher?
Yes. Coming along Kelsey Street there, minding my own business, and ran right into this scallywag rush. If I'd done right, I'd have called the policeman and had you thrown in prison.
Yeah.
He's a good boy.
Hey, Uncle Fletcher's going to Carberry with us.
Oh?
Aunt Bess invited him to come to UNC's piano recital, too.
receive a letter from Bessie, did you, Uncle Fletcher?
No.
Well, sure you did. You were just telling me about it.
Uh-huh. Sadie, remember Tracy Flanker's there in Belvedere?
No, I don't believe I do. Are you going to Carberry with us on Saturday?
Tracy Flanker's had a secret hiding place for his money a thief wouldn't discover in 30 years. It was up against the roof of his mouth. He had a little leather strap back there somewhere close to his tonsils with wires that hooked on his wisdom teeth. Baffle any burglar in the country.
Hey, that's an interesting thing.
Yes, Tracy Flanker.
Uncle Fletcher, Fresh tells me you heard from Bessie today.
I did. Mailman left a letter over at the house sometime during the afternoon. I wasn't there at the time. I was over at Miller's gasoline station. Fella pulled in with Missouri license plates. Elderly fella. I went in to chat
with
him.
Well, did Bessie invite you to come to Carberry on Saturday?
No.
Well, you said she did, Uncle Fletcher.
Please let me do the talking for about 5 seconds.
Well, if he's going to go, I won't have to go, will I? Make too many for Bess to find beds for if the whole gang of us traced
Please.
Up there.
Uncle Fletcher, there's something I have to get straightened out. Are you going to Carberry on Saturday?
Yes, I thought I would. Yuncey's going to play on the piano.
Yes. Well, do you plan
Yuncey
on...
Yuncey, Vic, performs a selection where she stomps on the white keys with both feet.
Is that a fact?
Yes.
I think you got that a little bit twisted. It isn't the white keys she stomps on with both feet. It's the loud pedal.
Let's say enclosed a printed program in the envelope. Good many of the different ones is going to play. Yuncey's best, though, I guess. I'd like to see her come stomping down on the white keys with both feet.
Well, are you going?
No.
Well, a minute ago you said you were.
I forget the name of the piece Yuncey's going to perform.
I remember it. The Aurora... let's see. The Aurora Borealis Elegy in Gallop.
That's right.
Composer's name is San Francisco.
Yes. No fellow move there. H.D. Glatz. Remember H.D. Glatz, Sadie? Belvedere fella?
No.
H.D. Glatz moved to San Francisco to spite his father-in-law. Who'd he marry, Sadie?
I don't know.
It was either Ivy Stover or Opal Sponk. H.D. Glatz married one of them, and Crawley Sopman married the other. They don't cut any ice either way, though. It's a case of six of one, half a dozen of the other. If H.D. Glatz didn't marry Ivy Stover, he must have married Opal Sponk. Well, whoever he married, they moved to San Francisco to spite his father-in-law. That's about all I remember about H.D. Glatz, and all I want to remember. I never liked H.D. Glatz. Never liked Ivy Stover or Opal Sponk either. A whole outfit of them can live in San Francisco, and I won't lose any sleep.
Uncle Fletcher, will you answer me one question?
Yes.
Are you going to Carberry on Saturday, or aren't you?
I enjoy watching Yuncey stomp down on the white keys with both feet.
It's a loud pedal she stomps down on with both feet, Uncle
Will Fletcher. Will you keep out of this, please?
Uh-huh.
You are going to Carberry again.
In the present program, it tells about a fella and his grandpa going to play the piano together. I wonder if the fella's going to sit in his grandpa's lap.
We'll have to find out whether he's going or not. It'll make a difference in our plans.
Well, I won't have to go if he goes, huh?
Of course you'll have to go.
Why?
Well, just because you will.
But Thunder, Beth and Walter haven't had a conversation.
Beth, they suggest I pack a lunch to eat on the train, Sadie.
Oh, does she? Well, then you are going.
Train stops 15 minutes in Mendota. If you want to get something in the depot lunchroom. But like Bessie says, it's pleasant to have your own shoebox with oranges and bananas and a few sandwiches. I always like to give the conductor a sandwich. If I give the conductor a sandwich or a cookie or some little dainty, and he don't get cross and impatient when you ask him if the train's on time. That's the main enjoyment I get on the train. I like to haul my watch out of my pocket and say, are we on time, conductor?
Then you are going.
Puts the conductor in a good humor if he's munching on a piece of bread and meat. You say, are we on time, conductor? And you'll sit on the arm of your chair and talk along free and easy as a horse. No, we're 2 minutes late, he'll explain. But we hope to make it up before we get to Freeport.
Then you are going.
No, I always put the conductor a little something to nibble on. Remember Arch Van Geekrock there in Belvedere?
No.
Arch Van Geekrock traveled from Yellow Jump, North Dakota, to Dismal Seepage, Ohio. Good long journey. He wanted to get on the good side of the conductor, so he gives him a sterling silver watch, a derby hat, $2 in cash, and introduced him to his niece that was just 22 years old and pretty as a picture. The conductor put the watch in his pocket, slammed the derby hat on his head, bought cigars and candy with the $2, and married the niece. Arch Van Geekrock tells it to this day it was the pleasantest trip he ever took in his life. This goes to show you how smart it is to shine up to the conductor.
Uncle Fletcher, are you going to Carberry Saturday or not?
No.
You're not?
I did have it in mind to help Tully Sanderson out at Muller's gasoline station Saturday afternoon.
Well, have you still got it in mind?
Tully Sanderson don't actually need me. Business is pretty strong.
Doorbell's ringing.
So see.
Most likely Bluetooth Johnson.
Fred and Ruthie, maybe.
Well, they wouldn't come without telephoning first.
Oh. Why are you looking at me, Sadie?
Oh, I was wondering if I ought to ask you whether you're going to Carberry next Saturday again or not.
You suppose Yuntzy takes off her shoes and stockings before she stomps on the white keys with both feet?
It's the loud pedal she stomps on with both feet.
Otto Hefler there in Sycamore used to be pretty good on the piano. He had a piano he made himself out of corn cobs, baling wire, and horsehair.
Telegram.
Never looked like a piano. Never sounded like a piano.
Telegram?
But Otto Hefler
yes, George.
Telegram?
Yeah, for you.
Where from?
Don't know. Can't tell.
Give it here.
Probably you recollect Otto Hefler, Vic. Married a woman 36 years old?
No.
He married a woman 36 years old without saying aye, yes, or no to anybody. I'll marry this woman 36 years old, he said to whoever'd listen. And he up and did it.
How old is he?
Otto Hefler's 40.
Oh.
Here's the telegram.
Who's this from?
Death.
Oh?
Yuntzy sprained her wrist, practicing, scraping her fingernails down along the white keys of the piano. Will not be in recital.
Why, say, that's too bad.
Yeah.
What's all this?
Little Yuntzy hurt herself on her piano.
Broke a toe, maybe.
Oh.
Broke a toe stomping on them white keys.
Mm.
Well, that's that, I guess.
How do you mean?
Well, we won't be going to Carberry.
Oh, yes, we will.
But say, did that poor little
child... We're going to Carberry on Saturday. All of us.
Those who remember Vic and Say delight in recalling the incredibly outlandish circumstances that were the mainstay of Reimer's humor.
I think it was the kitchenware dealers. We're going to have a convention, say, 10 years ahead, or more than 10 years ahead. In 1955, they're going to have a convention in Hawaii. And now, a convention 10 years ahead, and to Sadie, whose horizons were so small, and I think she'd be afraid of opening up anything extending too far away from home, you know. So he was all enthused in what they could do in Hawaii, and he talked about it quite a bit. He'd bring it up every now and again. He'd just wait till he'd sail off to Hawaii. And then she'd say 1955. Well, you know, it sounded like 2075, something like that. Anyway, she'd heard enough, and at one point she said, "Oh, that Hawaii, I wish it was in the middle of the Pacific Ocean." And she dismissed that. She just didn't want to hear any more about it. It was too far in the future. It was too far away from home. It had everything wrong with it.
B.B. Pantley discovered the second flavor in peanuts. And when Rush kind of scoffed at this, Vic says, well, he says, you know, you've had this experience. You've started a bag of peanuts, and the peanuts had one flavor, right? And when you're down the end of that bag, the peanuts have a different flavor, right? And Rush says, well, that's not it. He says, that's copyrighted in Washington, D.C. It took B.B. Pantley to discover that. That's the kind of discoveries that make people, you know.
Fletcher is complaining to say that his landlady, Miss Keller, is going away on a vacation. He's going to be gone a week or two, and she is going to put all of his meals for all the days out. Breakfast Monday morning is going to be on top of the piano. Lunch is going to be on top of the bureau in the bedroom, and so on and so forth. Where all these... He's quite put out about it.
And, of course, Uncle Fletcher, Clarence Hartzell, he's a 24-carat nut, and he was wonderful. I remember he told Rush one day that he was going to give him a piano for his birthday, but by parts. And he said, this birthday, Rush, I'm going to give you one key. And before the episode was over, Rush figured that it would take him 88 years just to get the keyboard, and the rest of the piano would, you'd have to live to be 150 if he got the strings. But Clarence, again, had his own bucolic type of humor that fitted in beautifully, this thing.
Oh, I loved the ones where Fletch would be reminiscing, bring over a cigar box full of mementos, or a photograph album showing the pictures of some of his old cronies and friends and what had happened to them, and This one that's now in a Missouri State Home for the Tall. And this one ran for mayor and got beat. And he ran for governor and got beat. He ran for Congress and got beat. Had one lifelong ambition to run for president and get beat. Something like that.
It was George McPulper also that had the exciting political life.
Who is it?
George McPulper ran for coroner and got beat. He ran for street commissioner and got beat. He ran for sheriff and got beat, and he ran for superintendent of schools and got beat.
Huh.
You know what his big ambition was, Vic?
No.
To run for mayor and get beat.
Oh, yeah. That's very funny.
You know, Vic, I never thought of that as being funny before.
Didn't you?
No.
Mr. Gumpox, the garbage man, drove a horse-drawn garbage wagon. Even Mr. Gumpox's horse figured in the doings up and down Virginia Avenue. The horse's name was Howard.
Mr. Gumpox had two suits. One was for Sunday and one was for every day. Would come a time when the old working suit was no longer good enough to wear any place, so then he would the Sunday suit on and buy a new one for Sunday. And the former Sunday suit would be the work clothes. So he showed up to stall to get Howard on Monday morning, and Howard saw the Sunday suit and wouldn't get up. He thought it was Sunday and he wouldn't go to work.
Howard had a sister who pulled a garbage wagon in another part of town. Years later, someone remembered.
Bill Cullen had a show out of New York some years ago. He played recordings of Vic and Sade, probably maybe from the station where he was working. I had put a few aside. And he ran them, and then he had a contest. I think, the contest was who could name Mr. Gumpox's horse, Howard's sister. The sister horse, Howard's sister, would sometimes take over for Howard, or I think worked for another garbage
that wasn't Bernice,
man. That was Bernice. And so Bill Cullen was offering a prize to anyone who could come up with a name of Gumpox's horse, Howard's sister. And the prize was free parking space, I think in Dismal Sea Beach, Ohio, or someplace like that. Yeah.
Sometimes the comedy spilled over into real life.
Oh, yes. I remember one time the script was to revolve around Sadie getting a new garbage box. And when Rush and Vic came home, she hauled him out to the alley to see this. She'd been so long in getting it. Her other was decrepit. And she finally had this spanking new beautiful garbage box. And she was so happy with it and so proud. She dragged him out to see it. She got out there. Well, the coincidence lay in the fact that my husband, being a doctor and a busy man, was a very infrequent visitor at the studio. We had our separate careers and neither one interfered with the other. And he loved my work, but my husband came down to pick me up, and I looked up, and there he was in the control room, and I was at the microphone, because reading the script, there I was out showing Rush and Vic my new garbage box, and I said, oh no, they couldn't look what they've done, all marked up. And Vic said, oh, it isn't all marked up, there's much, kids will do that, there isn't much. Look at that. It just ruined my beautiful garbage box. And what it said on it, she said, Bernadine loves Chester. And Paul couldn't have known that my Chester was coming to pick me up that night, because I didn't know it myself. And of any two words for the names of a man and a woman could be funnier than Bernardine and Chester. You try to find them. So that's what Paul had written on the garbage box, and there was my husband. So I had seen him, so I read it just like that, just with all the disdain and disgust in the world that Sadie was feeling.
At the beginning, at the very start, when Vic and Sade started, we broadcast in Studio B, which was a big barn-like studio that was used for musical shows. And way over in the corner, they had one of these tents erected. It was a three-sided thing with sort of a heavy burlap. It wasn't really burlap, but it was a heavy sound-absorbing material. In the middle of that was this box microphone. It was a show where we were supposed to run and go into the cellar where we were supposed to eat strawberries. And we rigged it up so there was a microphone in the tent and there was a microphone in the anteroom, which was, you know, like 50 feet away. And on the top of that mic, there was a box of strawberries for us. So we were going to run from this one microphone. We ran into the anteroom and started eating strawberries. And it was like being in a dark cellar. And we just did it because it seemed like more like acting, you know, and more theatrical. And I remember I kind of started to choke on the strawberries. They got caught in my throat. But there were a lot of things that happened like that in these early days. And we were convinced that nobody was listening anyway. So why worry about it? There were a couple of times where we got our pages mixed up. And we'd hand each other scripts. There was not much pressure because we felt at 8:15 in the morning there maybe were four or five people out there listening, and the pressure only built up later when the show became top rated and we were on for Procter & Gamble and so forth. But those early days were really funny and fun.
I'm not going to tell too many stories about Paul, but he always, I think, had a feeling that he had to outdo people or kick them off balance. For example, he went into a store on North Clark Street in Chicago that was going out of business and had been a photographer's shop. And he bought up these great big mammoth picture postcards, and you'd be enjoying a life of tranquility at NBC, and suddenly the mailman would come in, Paul Reimer would be on vacation, and the mailman would hand you a postcard. And on back of this postcard would be your name and address, NBC, and then overhear a message to you. Dear Robert, if you don't stop looking in my window while I am undressing, I am going to tell my father, signed Mabel. Well, of course, this had been read by every person in the mailroom, and everybody down the line that had a crack at it knew that Bob Brown at NBC was being assailed by some young lady for being a peeping Tom. And this was Paul Reimer's idea of fun.
I remember a director on the coast I had worked with in Chicago, and I was doing a show, I don't remember what it was, and he'd open the mic and say, Clarence, honey, would you go back to page so-and-so and take out the sentences of that top speech, and okay, Clarence, honey. Then he'd realize what he was doing, so he had to explain to the cast, he said, I'm using an old Vic and Sade gag when I do that.
The story about Reimer's mother, which is a true story, by the way, is she brought her sister in to Chicago, and Paul had set it up so they could go into the control room and see the show, and Paul's mother was just a very plain kind of housewife who really didn't understand radio at all. I mean, the whole thing was a mystery to her. Well, there were pickups from New York. There was an announcer in New York who did the commercials, and they cut from Chicago to New York to get the New York announcer doing the commercials. And she had been told that at one time or another, and didn't really know clearly why that was. But in bringing her sister on, she assumed a very authoritative air and a very professional air about this whole thing. And she was pointing out the various things in the control room, and that's what the man twists, and that's a microphone, and so forth. And then she saw the announcer out there, and she pointed to him, and she said, and you see that man? He's in New York.
But earlier than that, she came to Chicago one time fairly early in the show's history, and she took me aside, and she said, is Paul doing all right? I said, oh, Mrs. Reimer, he is considered one of the finest writers of comedy in the country. Well, she said, you know, I just kind of worry about him. And I said, well, of course you do. But, oh, he's respected everybody here and in New York and all over. His writing has been accepted as very fine. But once we were invited to Bloomington, and I think that showed Mrs. Reimer, and I'm so happy because she had every right to know that. They were honoring Paul. We were met at the station by the high school band, and we rode down the main street in an open car, standing and waving, you know, and Paul muttering what he would mutter under his breath. And we went to perhaps, I don't remember, could have been a high school gym or a Masonic lodge room or something for a fine dinner. And there was Mrs. Reimer up at the speaker's table, and they were saying these lovely things about her son, and I think it finally really got across that he was doing all right in Chicago. And then I remember one time Paul told us that Sister Bess lived in Carlisle, Illinois. We had another name for the town, but Bess was the one who'd write all those fine letters saying, dear sister and all, Walter's kneecap is let up. It was years before we knew there really was a Walter and Bess, you know. Anyhow, she went to Carlisle one time to visit them. And when she got back and Paul asked his mother, he said, well, how do they like the show in Carlisle? And she said, oh, you know those people. They wear those flat shoes. They don't listen. She was the non sequitur lady of all time.
And when we went on the air, it was quite a serious thing. We did it. Everybody, it was a serious thing. We were not doing a funny show. We were doing a serious show. And as a result, it sounded real. But going home after the show, I'd think back on some of the lines that I'd sit on the L train, I'd bust out laughing, and I'd get so embarrassed because I'd see people looking at, what the heck is he laughing at?
I remember some funny muffs. You know, when one of the funniest, Vic was supposed to come in and say, butterscotch pie. And on the air he came and said, scutterbotch pie, which made us all laugh so hard. And there were a number of things that happened like that where we would really break up. And it was almost impossible to continue. And especially when I was in adolescence, in the giggly stage, you know, I would break up and I just couldn't continue. I'd go over in the corner and Van and Byrne would ad-lib until I could kind of get myself together. And we were not helped at all by Paul Reimer, who would sit in the control room and laugh like a fool. I mean, the tears would stream down his cheeks. Because he would tell us that he had completely forgotten the script by the time it was on the air, which was maybe a week or two after he'd written it. And he said it was like absolutely fresh material that he'd never heard before. And when he heard it, he thought it was the funniest thing he'd ever heard in the world. And he would fall off his chair in there, you know. And I remember one show was, I would do anything to get a recording of this thing, was just Vic and I, and Vic was breaking in a pipe for his boss, Mr. Rubish. Well, he starts out very big explaining about pipe smoking, and he's such an authority, and how you tamp down the tobacco and everything. And then as he smokes the pipe, he gets a little sicker all the time as he goes. And he finally, he just belches, you know, and Rush says to him, gee, Gov, you look so strange. What's the matter, you know? And he can hardly speak. But Van and I used to break up at the end of this, so we couldn't really do it. And there was another one we did also where we were supposed to sing at a father and son's banquet, and we try to sing together, and we can't get it right. Well, we repeated this several times, and Van and I never got through this script. We never got through it, even though everybody in the control room got down behind the counter. They all got down behind the counter so we couldn't see their faces. And we just looked in the control room, and there was just nobody to be seen. They were all down under the counter. And Van and I looked at each other and just blew up. I would give anything to have tapes of those two shows. They were just unbelievable.
Before going on, let's take a moment out for station identification. We'll be back in just 5 seconds with a tribute to Vic and Sade.